This is Developer Stories, where we ask you why you built it, and we look behind the scenes of some of tech's passion projects and people. Welcome to the show. You're in the right place.
Welcome to Developer Stories. I'm Vanessa Sockett, and joining me today is Felix LeClaire, open source developer and HPC practitioner currently working in Canada. Felix has more knowledge and interest in hardware specs than, honestly, any person in HPC that I've ever encountered, specifically with specialization in C and x86 assembly optimization. Felix, it is a pleasure to have you on the show, and I am really excited to chat today.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
So to give our listeners a little bit of background for how I know you, you got involved with the HPC social project at the onset back in the day. No, it wasn't really that long ago, when Alan Sill was putting out a call to the community. And I was really kind of surprised and pleased about meeting you, because normally when we have these initiatives, I kind of find myself a little bit alone doing like a bunch of kind of preliminary work. I don't know if you'd call it grunt work, but just putting things together to kind of kickstart the community. But you were right there next to me the entire time. So first, I want to just say thank you. But second, I'll also say that's a really great quality to have. And I want the larger community to hear that about you. You are still fairly early in your career, so your kind of background story might be shorter than most. But could you walk us through the beginning? No, I'm just kidding. Possibly when you got interested in computers, and then lead us up to just where you are today.
Computer engineering was never a choice. Mom and dad are both computer engineers or computer scientists. And then that was always in the blood. Programming at age 8, first computer built myself in a big old air quotes at age 7. And then AV club and in the tech club back in high school, and then all through university for computer engineering. And then from there, leaving computer engineering and making my way into industry, finding community with HPC.social, and then now starting my current gig at Environment and Climate Change Canada, looking at performance, where we can use modern computing techniques to improve our mission of meteorological research.
Awesome. So we met through HPC Social, and I've definitely told that story. Alan has told that story. I think our listeners would be interested to hear your perspective about how it came to be and kind of where we are today.
HPC.social it's really, really cool. It's this amazing thing where I was just like a kid in a candy store trying to learn. I came at it from like a CFD optimization background as a hobby. And I was looking for, okay, what is this whole HPC high performance computing thing? Where can I find the people that are doing this day in, day out? And then I found this great community on Twitter, what was then Twitter, and started just being like the kind of young kid asking questions of all the experts who amazingly and full of patience would sometimes answer like quite truthfully of, oh yeah, this is the idea there, and this is why we do it this way instead of this other way, and here's our ideas for where we're going into the future. And then when the world happened and things changed, there was a need for something that that the community, which I had kind of, I was the young new guy, but I'd managed to kind of make my way into. We had a need for a place all our own that we could sort of design our own destiny around. And then at the time I had more time on my hands than I knew what to do with. And this opportunity came up to say, hey, we need people and we want to build a thing. So I was like, okay, yeah, I'm going to jump in here like a dirty shirt. What can I do? I have time and I have energy. Let's build this thing. Let's make sure we have a space where people in HPC, but also adjacent to HPC, can be themselves and share all their great ideas. That's outside of like an academic setting or an enterprise setting. Just you as people, share what you think is cool and move on from there.
Have you found that our new community on Slack and Discord and, you know, Mastodon, have you found that it's done its due justice to replace what we previously had on that bird place that we don't say the name of anymore? I'm just kidding. Well, I actually use Twitter and I really like Twitter. I'm just making a joke. But
oh, yeah. No, say I love Twitter. I am not a fan of X. I loved Twitter. So there's a little bit of context to that answer, but I'll answer what HPC.social has become first. I think in a lot of ways, yes. We're a lot of us come from, say, a research background or let's try something, see if it works. And if it doesn't work, well, then we'll have learned something and we can move on. So HPC.social was, okay, if and when we do have a place all our own, be it on Slack, on Discord, on Mastodon, on blog aggregators, on jobs, the jobs board, and so on, can we build a place that's all our own? And is that, can we build it? And the answer is yes, we did. But also, is that something that people will want to use and that is legitimately valuable? And I think in some ways has been. The jobs board, I know a few people who have gotten their jobs that way. Mastodon is continuing to grow. The Discord isn't super active, but the Slack is relatively active. And it's, if I want news about something, it's often the first place for ideas or for news to get shared. And part of that is also like people like to talk to each other, right? And that can be via text in a Slack channel. But simultaneously, we host a weekly HPC hallway huddle, right? An idea for practitioners from public sector, private sector, academia, or just hobbyists can get together and just talk about our love for HPC, things going on in the industry, and have a community of sharing that's very informal and very personable. As for Twitter, is HPC Twitter what it was 2 years ago? I don't think so. I don't think it's nearly as strong. I don't think it's as vibrant. Yeah, I won't go too far into the whys. Most of it is self-evident, I think. But it's still where a large portion of the community is. And the network effect is very strong. When everyone's using a thing, you want to be on that thing. And we're seeing the HPC community grow on Threads. And with Threads now working with Mastodon, partially, we'll see as updates continue to happen. We've seen a lot of the formerly huge names of Twitter, of HPC Twitter, say, Fernanda.
HPC Guru?
HPC Guru is on Mastodon, is not on Threads as far as I know, though. I may be mistaken. I may be mistaken, though. I still have to track down who the guru is. A few people know, and a few people have admitted to knowing, but they continue to elude me, as it were.
No, that's what Alan. That's what Alan still said. That it is your due responsibility if you know who HPC Guru is to never tell who HPC Guru is.
Yeah, Alan has this great story about like being sworn to it over a set of Tolkien books,
which I just that's amazing. I haven't heard that story.
Alan's great. Alan's one of the people I really look up to in the community, who when the call went out for, hey, we need volunteers, we need people that want to make this happen, is like, yeah, I'm here, let's do it. And that's sort of the wild thing about the community, and I'm sure you've seen this, heck, you're one of the people I look up to for that reason, is an understanding of like, hey, people want to do cool stuff and people are really passionate. Give them the means or put them in a position where they can succeed using that passion as a driver in a constructive way, and people will just go and do cool stuff or at least explore. And that's what a lot of this is, I think.
Yeah, and I'll suck at that. I think for me, Twitter is important because there's still a lot of the cloud native community there. I don't think that community in particular left. And I think it's so important to be bridging HPC and cloud and, you know, and work together. And if anything, the events of those years just made that more challenging. So I'm fairly active on both places, but yeah, it's unfortunate what happened, but it is what it is. So looking forward for HPC Social, what are you hoping for the community?
I want this to be a community that in 10 years' time, this doesn't have to become, I don't want this to become eventually a community that somehow morphs into a journal of some sort. I think it has to stay casual in a sense, where there's an understanding that a lot of the people here are working professionals, and a lot of what the things that happen in the community are job related. But at the same time, there's a lot of people where I can just send memes to friends, right? And it truly is a community of friends in a lot of ways, or of former colleagues. So What do I hope for? What do I want from the future? I want a place where people can be themselves and can let their guard down and share a joint passion for high performance computing, where you can make silly jokes and no one's immediately like, oh my God, I'm scared about even reacting to a joke because I'm associated with XYZ vendor. So the long and short of it is HPC.social is this great effort and I want it to survive and thrive. I want 5-10 years from now to be able to look back at this community and say, yeah, we're still kicking around. We don't have to be the biggest thing in the world, but the quality of conversation, the quality of the people there, the passion, the energies, the camaraderie that comes from so much of it, that's, I want HPC.social to encapsulate that and to be perceived as, yeah, that's where I know I can talk to friends and just let my hair down and just be around good, wonderful people all day long.
Absolutely. I agree with that so strongly. I really, especially the part that you said about friends. So let's do a quick change of topic. I want to talk about some of the things that you're passionate about. So of course, one of them is compilers and systems and low-level architectures. Also Formula One racing. I don't know if those two things are connected in some way, but can you kind of, I guess, add to your story a little bit of context of how you got interested specifically in those things?
Yeah. So my world into the, my entrance into the world of HPC was a little bit different, shall we say. So I'm a huge Formula One nerd. And one of the things I wanted to do also as an engineering student at the time was one of the things that, without diving too deep into it, is that Formula One is basically a giant science fair of different CFD, different material engineering, different combustion engineering, where they try to iterate and change for the different racetracks every week. Are you at higher altitude? Well, that means you have less air coming into the engine, right? And then, oh, that changes your compression ratios, but that means you also have less drag. So how do you optimize, right? And one of the things I was super curious about as an engineering student at the time, who was in computer engineering studying, was, hey, I want to simulate those cars on my personal computer. And how do you do that? Well, it turns out that the standard for CFD, computational fluid dynamics in Formula One, for the most part, is this great piece of software called OpenFoam, which is not fun to build, but once you build it, it works pretty well. And I thought, young, silly kid that I was, that, oh, okay, this seems really slow. Couldn't be that hard to optimize it and make it faster. So OpenFoam led to looking into and learning about BLAS, the basic linear algebra subprogram, which is a standard that we've had for over 20 years now for how do we do math on computers and how do libraries expose the ability to do really common math operations. So are you doing a matrix multiply? Well, you're not going to be doing that every weekend. You're just going to have one team of people do it really, really well for your piece of hardware, and then you can move on to doing the real work. Well, I thought I would be one of those people, and it turns out eventually I would become one of those people. So that sort of led to my entrance into HPC was, hey, let's make these math routines faster. But to make it faster, without getting too far into it, one of the things you have to do is you have to know, okay, how many cores do I have? How much memory bandwidth do I have? How do those cores like to talk to each other? Or, hey, I'm on a GPU, but that GPU uses work splitting between how it's architected. And that means that you have locality problems, temporal locality, spatial locality, problems with communicating even within a GPU, let alone when you're on a big cluster like an El Capitan or an Aurora, right? How do you spread that work out in a reasonable way to solve your math and do your simulations? So realizing that I wasn't going to be able to learn all that right away, that led to some work with Intel, that led to getting obsessed to this day with floating point 16, and that led to working on and with Intel on like standards of, okay, how do we want to expose these ideas?
Okay, so I have to ask, this is something on my mind. There's a lot of movement at major tech companies and perhaps in standards groups to change the precision of chips. in a way that would not be great for science. So scientific models are obviously not going to run as they need to on these lower precision chips that many vendors or cloud companies that are making hardware are planning for, with the use case of optimizing for the AI ML, which, you know, it's great. It would be great to optimize for that and to have, you know, lower costs for training these models. Absolutely. But on the other hand, science potentially could suffer if, you know, it's not that HPC is going to go away and we won't have machines with higher precision, but if we're becoming more reliant on cloud to do our science, what if there is some future where we don't have the actual resources that we need?
Life gets complicated. Yeah, so let's kind of set the stage. So in 1985, well before my time, a specification came out called IEEE 754. I forget the exact name on the document, but essentially it's why we have single precision floats, floating point numbers, and double precision floating point numbers. And that was all fine and dandy. A lot of work could be done in single precision. And then if you really needed to do something, then you could do it in double precision. And single precision was 32 bits. And because double precision had we call it double precision because it had twice as many bits as single precision. That's all fine and great. But then we realized, and it was actually, we can thank the games programmers for a lot of this, where they were looking at, hey, we're doing math for games, but we really don't need 32 bits. Because when you think about it, if you look at a screen, each pixel on a screen needs three different pieces of data, one for the red, one for the green, one for the blue. And then if you're looking at 1080p, so that's 1920 pixels wide by 1080 pixels tall, well, that's about 2 million. And then you look at it and say, oh, okay. And then each one of those pixels needs three floats. So that's 6 million pieces of data. And each of those is 32 bits wide. That's a lot of data to push. And then if you look at screens, they're pushing that like 60 times, these days 120 or more times per second. So they really quickly realized, hey, this is way overkill for the sort of stuff we're doing. So what if we had, I don't know, instead of if double is twice as many as a normal float being 32 bits, what if we had one that was, I don't know, half as precise and did 16 bits? And that was super useful as an idea and as a concept because, hey, you know what? We're taking up half as much memory bandwidth. We're taking up half as much space in our registers when it comes to optimizing this sort of thing. And it's way less overkill. So instead of waiting on data to arrive from memory or from disk, we can spend more time doing real math and actually solving, be it pushing pixels to the screen. So in 2008, we got a revision to IEEE 754. And what it did is said, okay, we're going to have this 16-bit type that's a standard across all the hardware. And we're also going to have 128-bit floats for, like, say you're doing neutrinos into a black hole and you need some massive, massive delta between your precision of different boundary conditions. Okay, fine. You need 128-bit float. Fine. Now you have it and you have it as a standard. We got that with the IBM Power Series stuff, Power 9 specifically. So looking at AI ML, one of the things they ran into is, hey, we need a lot of orders of magnitude, but the precision actually isn't all that important to the stuff we do. So the Google was the big predominant force behind something known as Brain Float 16. And the idea was, hey, we need all the orders of magnitude that a 32-bit float can have, but we don't need all the precision bits that a 32-bit float can have. At the same time, we need more orders of magnitude than what floating point 16 has. So FP16 that the games programmers and the phone programmers were using, well, that doesn't work super well for AI ML at that point. So what they said was, hey, let's just cut truncate would be the scientist's like hardware term for it. Let's just truncate a 32-bit float and then store it that way. And then we can have twice as much memory bandwidth and we can get twice as much data into our registers per clock cycle, right? One of the kind of gremlins that's in the background of a lot of modern HPC systems is that while compute has grown exponentially, our memory bandwidth has not, our memory capacity, our memory bandwidth has grown at nowhere near the rate of previous systems and previous generations. So let's say it used to take you 10 nanoseconds to do a piece of math. Well, you'd be waiting on memory for, I don't know, maybe 40, 50 nanoseconds to give you an idea of like orders here. So, okay, you're taking four times as long, but if you're doing, say, a multiply and an add and then another multiply, well, that's, and each of them, those take 10 nanoseconds. Well, hey, then when by the time you're finished doing your math, your next piece of data has already arrived and you can feed the beast. One of the issues we have these days is that math happens in around 1 nanosecond on average, but memory is on the order of 100 or 200 nanoseconds. So getting data to feed your CPU or your GPU or your vector engine or your FPGA and so on and so forth, that's where we spend a lot of the time just with our clock, with the CPU just spinning and just waiting on data. It's data starved. So if you think about it as, hey, I can only move 64 bits at a time down from memory, high level example. Well, if you go and say, hey, what if I have that 64 bits fixed amount I can move at a time, but that can be one 64 bit float or it can be two 32 bit floats. Oh my God. And then the AI folks come around and say, hey, we really don't need all that much precision. We can fit four brain floats in that 64 bits at a time. So comparatively, they're having a 4x speed up in data arriving. So they're able to feed the beast at a significantly higher rate, which, okay, that's great for the AI folks, but where does that leave HPC and classical computing, right? HPC has a reputation for wanting everything at double precision, but there's a lot of stuff that we already do at single precision with 32-bit floats. And we do it at 32 bits because we can't do it at 16 bits. Okay, great. Now, from there, we're kind of talking about optimization and where you can apply these ML types and so on. One of the things that's kind of in vogue right now is exploring something called mixed precision, where what if you had data in one place and you stored it in one precision and then did all the math where you actually need all the precision at a higher precision. In essence, you go, hey, I've only got that 64 bits of space. What if I did two operations? I brought in two 32-bit floats, converted them in my register, because that's like 1 nanosecond to convert between the two, to 64-bit, did all my math in 64-bit, where I'd actually need all the precision between steps, and then converted back to 32 bits and stored that to memory. You effectively get the 2x speed up of doing everything in 32-bit, but your actual math, because it's happening at a higher precision, you don't lose out on the quality of results and the quality of science that you're outputting from your simulation. So that's where HPC can sort of learn or take advantage of a lot of the advancements that we're seeing from the cloud vendors, from the GPU vendors, and so on and so forth.
I really like that metaphor of feeding the beast at a higher rate. That's how I'm forever going to think of that. When you talked about being data starved, you're kind of getting into the idea of utilization, because something is sitting around and waiting. And arguably, if it's doing that, it's not being maximally utilized. This is a big question because it's a term that probably will have a different definition based on how you ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So I'm interested, how would you define utilization? How do you measure it? And how do you think the major HPC centers are doing with respect to maximally utilizing their resources?
There are so many different answers to that question. So at my level, I think of utilization as, hey, I've got 2 billion cycles per second, right? How many of those cycles are doing useful work, right? That's where my brain goes to in utilization. And if I can feed the beast better, then more of those cycles are spent doing something actually useful, right? And one of the things that you can never decouple from the term utilization is also power draw. So one of the things that happens when you're spinning around and just waiting on data is that modern processors are really good at sitting idle when there's actually nothing going on, right? When you're just waiting for a job to come in from, say, Slurm or something. But when you're waiting on data, you can't actually turn down a lot of the, you can do some stuff, but for the most part, you're still at a relatively high power state. So you're doing no effective work, but you're still burning a bunch of cycles just doing nothing, which isn't all that great. Simultaneously, one of the kind of counter arguments to the lower level precision stuff that I hear often is, yeah, but your results aren't as good. So yeah, your utilization has gone up, but because your results aren't as clean or as precise, I struggle with that, but all the same, hey, you're better to be underutilized with higher quality results from the get-go than do mixed precision and say, hey, my results aren't quite as good, but I got them way faster, right? Twice as fast, let's say. And I get that. Same time, if the argument is going to be, well, my results are more precise at double precision, then I'm going to hit back with, well, why aren't you doing numerical methods to have infinite effective precision, right? Why aren't we doing everything at 128-bit or using what the specifications define for 256-bit floats to do all of our math? Because, hey, more precision equals more better. So there's a balance point. And a lot of the HPC centers have a mission of, hey, we need to update the weather with this amount of resolution, say 1 kilometer squared resolution, and we need to do that every 10 minutes. And then you look at your system and say, okay, I've got this size of system and my algorithms are good. My model inputs are good, but hey, I'm not going to be able to meet that quality of service, right? I'm not going to be able to hit that target. Can you do every 10 minutes? Well, then I can say, hey, does it really matter if it's 3.111111 or do you only care about 3.11111, right? How many decimal places do you actually care about when you're doing a weather forecast every 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, right? So I look at it as, hey, how can we match the math we're doing to the actual needs of the organization and the purpose that we're serving? Now, opposite side, let's look at HPC resources, be they in the cloud, be they in like the big national labs in the States, up here with Environment Canada, and Shared Services Canada, or the big systems, say Barcelona over in the EU, or Lumi, so on and so forth. When we look at utilization, you're looking at, hey, there's hardware that's just never being used, or it's rarely being touched. So it's sitting idle all day. And is that a good thing? Well, someone's paid for it, be it the taxpayer, be it private industry developing their own centers, be it the cloud vendor. Someone's paid for that hardware to be there. It took a lot of carbon and a lot of energy to produce it. And if it's not doing any useful work, well, that's not great. But I'd also rather spend more time getting engineers, developers, researchers to work on the quality of their codes so that they can get results faster and more efficiently and have that sit idle than have it burn cycles for some arbitrary metric of, oh, we want at least 90%, say, common utilization at all times, right? And people talk about like right-sizing your nodes, right-sizing your cloud instances. And that's all true and that's all very correct. But if the problems you're trying to solve allow for, hey, I can spend more time refining my algorithm, refining how I approach the problem, well, then you're better off from a utilization standpoint to make sure that, hey, when I'm using a piece of hardware, I'm using it to its maximum capabilities. And better that if it's not going to be utilized all the way, let it sit idle, get in a super low power state so that we're not burning carbon, that we're not burning power for no apparent reason, right? That's kind of how I'd look at the utilization issue overall.
I really like the point you made about matching. I think you said something like matching the math to what the problem needs. I would guess that with scientific models, it's less, maybe with something like climate science, and I'm not in this area, so I'm just speaking very naively, but it's not about just, you know, one point in time for weather forecasts, but they want to save some state of truth about the world over time that they can look at over time and understand how things change. And then if there's sort of deviation, given that you've tried to keep everything consistent, so your precision, et cetera, then you can try to either account for that error by some change in, I don't know, in still the underlying machine or actually some change out in nature, which is probably what folks are interested in. you know, arguably maybe with like, you know, specifically for climate, and when if things really start to pick up and change, maybe the changes will be so large that that level of precision doesn't matter. But I think there's sort of an underlying assumption in what we're talking about that you are not able to do science if or understand phenomena in the world, you don't have the highest of precision. And I think what you said about, you know, arguably, why don't we go in the other direction? Why don't we make it even higher? Like that, that's a really good argument, because in some ways, like the choices that we've made for the current design are sort of arbitrary, right? Like there's no reason that it couldn't have been, you know, a much higher precision. And then we would still be making the same argument. So it's almost like, if the world is changing and we can feed the beast at a higher rate, maybe it's really just that the scientific communities that have this assumption that they need a particular precision to do their science, maybe they just need to rethink how they're doing their science and find a new strategy that still gives insight to some truth about the world, but feeding the beast at a higher rate. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, yeah. So one of the... I think it's important here that I kind of clarify a little bit, where I said climate, and where I'm working right now is meteorology. So the weather forecast, some of the work when you're projecting out tens of thousands of epochs, right? And you're looking, where are we going to be in 100 years or 1,000 years or 10,000 years? Well, those are areas where, yeah, you know what, you're not going to use a 16-bit float. That's just not going to happen. It's just not, right? And you're going to need a 32 or a 64-bit float. And it's true that a lot of the things that we were capturing, we want the highest quality of data captured today. But when it comes to the forecast for 10, 15, 20 minutes from now, we don't, much like sizing an instance, if you're looking at the cloud, right sizing and looking at like, what do I actually need? Not what do I want in an ideal utopian world where all math is free and power is free and time is irrelevant to getting my results. We have a need and we need to produce this now, right? It's an engineering problem of like, hey, there's this thing. It needs to happen on time or else problems happen, right? And looking at what do I need to solve my actual problem? So I think it's important to kind of distinguish that. Where, and to kind of go back a few tangents, when we were talking about like the AI folks and them wanting lower and lower and lower precision, well, they're looking at it as, hey, these math folks, these computer scientists, these researchers and so on, they had this spec for floating point. And you know what? It's a good spec. Floating point isn't perfect, but it's so good. And it's so much better than everything that existed before it. But it's way more than what we need. And we need compute and we need results. So if we can go and say, hey, hardware vendors, or even do it themselves in the case of Google with their TPUs, Amazon with their Inferentia and Trainium products, and soon Microsoft with their Maya 100 accelerators, they're looking at it as, hey, we know what our problem size is. We don't have to generalize across concepts. We can say, hey, this is exactly what we need. Let's build something really efficient and really fast for that problem set. The same way we looked at say, we were talking about graphics programs earlier on the screens. Well, GPU vendors went, hey, you know what? We really don't. We need 64-bit floats to be compliant with some language requirements. But in terms of performance, like games are only ever 32-bit and often 16-bit because that's all they need. Because those RGBs on your screen are only 8-bit. Most of the time, if you have a really nice high-end HDR screen with all the bells and whistles, maybe it's 10 bits per channel. You don't need a 32-bit float for each of those channels, right? So they looked at it as a hardware vendor of saying, hey, there's an increase in power, there's an increase in silicon area needed, and there's a performance cost to doing everything in 64-bit because bigger registers, increases latency between memories and caches, so on and so forth, and a raw cost. And like, hey, we just need a bigger piece of silicon, like physical silicon. You just need more to support a bigger type. And they said, hey, let's support the 64-bit stuff, the 64-bit floats. But most of our customers use, say, 16 times more 32-bit. then they do 64-bit. So let's give them 16 times, 32 times, 64 times more 32-bit performance by just having more of that on the physical raw die. And you size things according to what you need. And once again, to get away from like the idealized idea of, hey, silicon vendors, your Intels, your AMDs, your NVIDIAs, your Apples, your NECs, and so on, they're going to make a product. And they're going to make that product for as many customers as they can to use. And to your point of like, will there be any 64-bit for those of us that need it? Well, yes, but it's not going to be as fast. 64-bit performance has kind of plateaued in the last decade. If you look at a 2012 GTX Titan from the Kepler generation of NVIDIA, it was a 1 teraflop workstation GPU. And if you get the latest RTX something or other from NVIDIA, what's the 64-bit performance on the desktop workstation card? It's around 1.1, 1.2 teraflops. That's just what you can get on the desktop because they've seen, hey, for the simulation work or for the engineering workloads on the desktop, customers just aren't demanding or they're not a big enough market to demand that 64-bit performance. On the HPC side, when you're looking at an Aurora or you're looking at an El Capitan, a Perlmutter or so on, these really big, massive systems, then it's like, hey, these are HPC systems first and foremost. So yeah, they need 64-bit performance and they need to be really good with it. So you'll see NVIDIA have their matrix cores if you're doing matrix math, and those support 64-bit floats because that's one way where it's not as generalized the performance, but in terms of total silicon area to give reasonable performance upticks to HPC customers, HPC users, hey, we can hit 37 teraflops. And that's a huge upgrade, huge, huge upgrade. But it's only because the customer demanded it and the customer needed it. When you're looking on the desktop or a normal consumer devices, they just don't need 64-bit floats. It's just not relevant. As much as I'd love them to actually be doing extended quad floats of 128 bits for every problem ever, and there's not enough people that need that. Not want that, but need that to justify the expenditure. It's a lot, and we can't have everything. Silicon vendors are going to need to make a profit somewhere. And if they can cut out something that people aren't using and don't need, well, they're not going to put it on the chip because one engineer really wants it. As much as that engineer might be really passionate and might write really nice blog posts about the death of 64-bit floats, it's like, no, we can't justify it, which is why you see less and less 64-bit floats on GPUs or some current generation GPUs. Like if you look at Apple's built-in GPUs on their silicon, in fancy MacBooks, well, they don't have any 64-bit floats on the GPUs. If you look at Intel with their current generation ARC cards, not their HPC GPUs, but their desktop ARC cards, ARC Alchemist, those have no 64-bit floats whatsoever because that's what the customer needed for the target and the market segment that they were targeting.
It's a little scary, I think, to think about some kind of future where there's these specific kinds of climate models that maybe won't have support. But on the other hand, you have to kind of consider the economics of the entire thing and what customers are demanding and how the world is changing and realize that things will not be how they always have been and that, you know, change is going to happen. And it doesn't always mean that it's going to be like a dire outcome. I think probably scientists, people that work for scientists on the infrastructure need to kind of step up and figure out a solution or a way to provide what is needed. But yeah, it's I don't think I have any answer for it. You know, it's a hard problem.
It's a hard problem. And there's something comforting, kind of a little bit of inside baseball, is like there's something comforting that 64-bit floats have been around since 1985 and they're pretty much as good as it's gotten. It feels stable, right? It feels like, hey, I can just do my research in 64-bit and I never have to think about it, which if you think of like a high level research standpoint where people are not computer scientists and they have their biggest interaction with HPC is, yeah, I have a grad student who takes all my research, converts my equations into code, and then runs that on the big supercomputer that the university IT center runs, right? Not having to think about the precision because it was like, is it more than I need? Yeah, but the performance is fine for the research I'm doing, right? And not having to think about it is like, hey, bonus. but then you try to scale that up and that doesn't scale. So this kind of wraps into my other interest and passion, which is like low level optimization of, hey, we do all this work to enable researchers to do as much productive work in their areas of interest and their areas of study as possible. But at some point, those abstractions have got to give, right? We can't hide that all away from them. And bad code and poorly, and that's not to say grad students write bad code, but they've got a lot on their plate. And if you have a research group of like 20 odd students between postdocs and master students, and PhDs, and you only have like one or two of them that can actually write code, and they're all doing that on top of their normal workload, like that's not going to be the best code in the world. And we build abstractions to help these people, these students, these developers. But that doesn't, at the end of the day, we can only abstract so far away from the machine, right? Which has been the really interesting part of the last like 5-10 years has been the rise of like, okay, we actually have to support a profession of people whose job it is to understand what researchers are trying to do, but have a background in computer science, computer engineering, software engineering, whichever, to be able to support and convert the ideas, the papers, and do real science based off them and convert them into something that we can actually run on our clusters and run in a reasonable amount of time, right? If some researcher wants to run code from the 70s that they wrote in the first edition of Fortran 77 and still somehow compiles to this day, and they're fine with running that single threaded and taking up one node on one core on one server in one rack in one building, well, fine, let them do that. But if that same researcher then starts complaining about, oh, nothing is fast anymore, it's like, well, come on, this is 50-year-old code. What do you want me to do with this, right? There's a part of us where it's like we're supporting and we're trying to help people, but we can't, if they won't even put the effort in to help themselves, how can we move forward on the simulation side of like getting stuff done, right?
Oh my God, that is 50 years. I feel like, yeah. I am so old. I mean, I wasn't born 50 years ago, but like I was pretty close.
Yeah. I
thought 1970 was just like 25 or 30 years ago. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, it's weird for me because I'll go through and I'll be reading like the meeting minutes from IEEE discourse on like how do we do encoding. And it's like, oh, this was published over twice my age ago. It's like, oh. Oh no.
Oh no.
Right? Oh no. Right? Some of the people that were on these committees have had children who have had children who have graduated and then worked on those same codes, which is just, it's like, okay, that's kind of cool in some ways. It's like, oh my God, that code was either really good or really resilient or really important. But it's survived and it's a legacy in a lot of senses. And legacy gets thrown around as like a dirty word in HPC or in computing in general a lot of the time. But there's some things that are legacy because they worked really well and it was too expensive or it was too difficult or it was too entrenched to be able to move on from that, right? Like, okay, I talked about 32-bit and 64-bit floats. Those came by accident somewhat because in 1979, 1980, Intel put out a coprocessor for their 16-bit microprocessor. It was called the 8087 or the X87. A lot of people know it for its 80-bit float or long double. That still to this day, if you use long double in your code, it is that 80-bit float that was compliant with the floating point coprocessor that you had to slot in as an extra card physically into your IBM PC back in 1980. It's like, oh my God. So a little bit of history, I guess.
Very cool. So to kind of shift a little bit, and we're definitely coming up on time, I want to finish and just talk a little bit more about you. So what do you like to do in your free time when you're not kind of hacking on computers?
I try to discover the identity of HPC guru. No, very much joking there. I don't know. I spend a lot of time in and around the compiler space, but that's still computer related. I like biking to work. Biking to work is fun. Up here, I'm currently based out of Ottawa, and I would normally be out hiking in the snow, cross-country skiing or something of the likes, but we've not had much snow, so that's not been happening as recently. There's a project. I've mentioned like my love of Formula One earlier, and cars are cool, and aerodynamics are cool. They're for people smarter than me, but they're really interesting. So something I've been working on for a while is I'm actually designing my own kind of Formula One style car in CAD. And I'm hoping to build it before the end of the decade, where it's the whole thing built from scratch, taking something called a Wankel rotary engine, which instead of pistons going back and forth, it's basically a spinning Dorito. that
a spinning Dorito.
I know the line. So that's what kind of I've been doing that, and then working on some cool, there's a cool transmission that VW built called a DSG, which if you translate to English is a dual clutch transmission. So for those who have driven standard cars with manual transmission, it's actually an automatic version of that, where you actually have all of your odd gears are on one transmission and all of your even gears are on the other. So you can actually instantly switch between the two. Really cool, interesting stuff, invented by Formula One in the 90s. So I've been kind of building that and planning that out as a personal project for a while.
Awesome. So Felix, it has been so fun chatting with you. We dove in very deep to talking about precision and architectures. And honestly, I wish we had more time, but I will put a shout out to the HPC Huddle, because these are the kind of things that are talked about every week. And it's really fun. And you can also meet other folks in the HPC social community and Alan Sill. And yeah, so anyway, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Vanessa.